Session number 14806, Eddie Murray, part 28.
Right, Eddie Murray, tape 14, second side. Eddie Murray, tape 14, second side. You were just saying that
the television
was delivered.
This was a rear projection television. I think it was given to him by his great friend, Lord Beaverbrook.
Uh-huh.
And we went down there he had a horse running, and we switched it on. And of course, I knew very little about television sets. We had television at home, but it was quite a novelty, really, to have one which was a little bit complicated like this one. And so I fiddled about with it and eventually got a picture, and then it all went white spots and snow, and we couldn't see the picture at all. Of one of his horses that were running, and ever after that, you know, he was very, very unkeen, if you like, to watch television.
Mm.
He preferred to go to the races himself,
right,
of course, to watch his horses.
And did he? And did he watch the news, he didn't get his news from the radio or the TV?
No, news bulletins, of course, were prepared by the secretaries. They would listen to the radio, and prepare it and write it out. Most of the time, like on board ship, too.
Okay.
You know, on the Onassis yacht, the radio used to take the news and then come along to, because he was German, Eric, and he would come along and get me to look through it.
As the radio operator?
Yeah. We're still in correspondence, as
really?
A matter of fact. He lives in Hamburg, married, no children,
uh-huh.
Travels a lot,
uh-huh.
Lovely character.
So he got over the papers and music, military music.
Ah, you know. No, he didn't mind military music. Or some of the old songs. We're soldiers, yes, soldiers of the Queen,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So it was mainly military music mm-hmm. that he liked.
Mm-hmm. And apart from on his hobbies and interests, I mean, he got painting, building. He got horses.
Oh yes, horses.
Follow the horses.
I think it was in 49 that he had his last ride to the hunts, but he didn't really participate in the chase. That was
really?
Down. Yes, that was with the I don't know what they're called, the Mid Kent or something uh-huh. like this. But of course, he loved to go to see any of his horses run,
mm-hmm.
And so we travelled all over the southwest and even down to Brighton to watch his horses run.
Right.
And he always had, bets on them.
Mm-hmm.
But his trainer was Walter Nightingale, the late Walter Nightingale, and he was known to be the most hopeful, optimistic trainer,
really?
In Britain. And so he would always give a good report of any of Sir Winston's horses before they started and before they ran. And so Winston would put, he was never a great big backer, punter.
Mm.
Christopher Soames used to deal for the most part with putting his bets on. But when Christopher wasn't there, that's the late Lord Soames, of course, who was once our ambassador in Paris,
mm-hmm.
and his wife, Lady Mary, still, is very, very interested in our International Churchill Society. She's
mm-hmm.
our patron.
Mm.
And so Christopher used to deal mainly with the horses. But we used to go along to Lingfield, where at one time he had a string of 18 horses, in training there.
Really? Churchill himself had 18
yes,
horses,
yes.
really?
Mm-hmm. And occasionally they bought their food for their grain for the rest of the year, for the year.
Right, right. I was trying to think. Apart from that, and his travels, and did he have any other hobbies?
He loved touring, shall we say,
mm.
as an individual. Any place we went to, for instance, on the Onassis yacht, or even if we were in Monte Carlo, we would go for trips around the hinterland.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like the towns and the cities and that
mm.
sort of thing, but he was a great lover of the beauty of the mm. hinterland, especially in Provence
mm-hmm.
or Alpes-Maritimes.
And so we covered really the interests and so forth. One thing I meant to ask you was that, I mean, was he very punctual or no.
he also loved fires.
Fires.
He'd visit fires. I remember us stopping at Crystal Palace when there was a fire there, you know, not the great fire, but a fire that occurred very much later in the 50s. And he stopped off there and we walked over in his carpet slippers over fire, past fire engines and over hoses and all the rest of it just to get a better view. The firemen didn't like it, but they took it as a great joke. And even you know, it showed his admiration for the fire service, do you see?
Yes.
And so they were quite happy to sort of give us a little bit of hand to get as close as possible to have a good view. But as far as punctuality is concerned, well, he liked to be punctual. And if he was punctual ever, he would always point out to the people concerned that he was punctual. But it was it wasn't very often. If he was punctual, it was because of Joe Bullock, the driver, and myself getting him through the traffic jams with the use of our police bell that I had fixed on the car that we had. Not only during the time that he was at Hyde Park, at number 10, but we had it fixed on the Humber Pullman. That we used when he was not in office.
Right.
And this got us, you know. But then the police, the uniform police, were so, so helpful. And if we were going to the theatre, for instance, I would give them a ring and, you know, get in touch with the local chief constable or chief of police, traffic and that sort of thing, and suggest that it might be possible to have a parking space in front of the cinema or the theatre for Churchill, and never ever did we have any complications as far as that were concerned. And it was wonderful because immediately the police knew that he was coming. They'd reserve, you know, they'd put the bollards up, and then people used to, they'd even put tapes across the road, you know, and people would gather behind knowing that something was going to happen, and nine times out of ten they knew that it was Winnie, that was Winston that was coming. And the cheers that used to go up, you know, how on earth those people, you know, could kick him out of office in 1945 was, you know, it was always on my mind. How could they have done that when everywhere we went in London or elsewhere, there were always crowds, you know, that would cheer him. Always. And so he would try to be punctual. And when we left Chartwell, for instance, to go to the House of Commons, he would always take out his, look at his wristwatch and look at his gold watch, pull out his gold watch and check the time that we left, and then he would leave it to the last minute. And we did it, just do it in about 45 minutes.
So from Chartwell?
From Chartwell to the House of Commons, to the Ladies' Gallery entrance. And if we got
you'll
there...
You'd be pushing to do that today, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes, indeed. When I lecture, I always say, you know, that in those days it was 45 minutes, but when we went across to the other side, to his constituency, in those days, and in those days it used to take about 3 hours. Today it would take about 6 hours with the motorway.
So, yes.
I'm a bit sarcastic about motorways.
Sure.
And so we start out nude. As soon as we arrived at Ladies' Gallery entrance, that's in the inner courtyard, he'd look up to Big Ben, take out his pocket watch again, which had been handed down to him, you know, for generations. And you'd look at it and check with Big Ben, you know, check that Big Ben was all right. And then he'd, you know, then he'd put it away, having noted how many minutes, you know, had made a mental note of how many minutes. And the next time we left Chartwell, you know, I would go and say, you know, well, you know, you're cutting it rather short. We're cutting it rather fine, you know, we've got 45 minutes. But the last time we did it in 44, you know.
Really?
Come out with this. A mental note.
Just
wonderful.
Tell me about the impersonations. Did everybody do the impersonations? I mean, a lot
how
of
do
people
mean?
do impersonations.
No.
Churchill.
I think I do a very good impersonation
yes.
when I put my mind to it.
Yes.
But I'm afraid I've always been disappointed when watching...
Yeah.
The various people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know,
what like do you think of people? I think Robert Hardy, the actor, does.
Well, Robert Hardy, I'll be seeing him on, you know, on the 8th. He's a yes. frequent visitor. He's a member of the International Churchill Society. Yes. And he played a pretty good young Winston, you know. And I'm afraid this that my knowledge of Winston was during the last 15 years of his life, do you see? Mm. And this rather clouds my idea of him during the war years, if you see what I mean. And so I'm perhaps on occasions I'm a little bit naughty in thinking that the personalities that play his play his part on the screen are not very good. Mm. But I think that, you know, honestly speaking, nobody plays it. Plays him extremely well.
Mm. Did he ever catch you doing impersonations?
Oh, no. This was something that I would never... No. I had a great admiration and respect and even love for Churchill. Mm. And, you know, there were occasions, I was just going to say, you know, if we were out in the garden at Chartwell and he would say, there's the cat or something like that. And then I might say a few words imitating him, you know, and it... He would sort of chortle a little, you know.
Really?
And then he would say, you know, well, quite right, you know. I remember on one occasion when
he didn't mind
Didn't mind it at all. But it didn't register to me at the time that he didn't mind me imitating him. It didn't register at all, so I never did it. And if I did so, it was, you know, without thinking, really. But there was one occasion when... Turning right out of the door of Chartwell, walking down, there was a laburnum there. And I noticed one day that it wasn't only yellow, there were pink blossoms upon it as well. And so I looked at it and I told him, you know, there are pink blossoms and yellow blossoms. So he said, it's magnificent, isn't it? And he said, well, very nice. And we carried on walking. And then he said, you were right the first time. It is magnificent. And so I said, well, that's what I said. It was magnificent.
And you didn't realize you were saying it wrong.
And so we agreed then. And then it was Pitt Blader, I think, at the time, who was who had been with Attlee. And he was there. And so the old man turned to... You might, well, nobody in particular, but Mr. Pitt Blader was there and I was there, you see. And so he turned around, you might find out why, you know, why. He wouldn't go into details or anything. And so you might find out, you see, why there are pink blossoms and yellow blossoms. You know, you might find out why, leaving it up to us, you know, to discover what he was talking about, see. And so... Pitt Blader came back sometime afterwards. We walked past the same, and Pitt Blader said, you know, that he hadn't been able to discover it. The only thing that the horticultural people had said, was that it was probably a freak. Well, I know, bloody well, it's a freak. But why so? You see? And then I apologized to Pitt Blader, and I said, I've had a word with the gardener. And apparently it's natural that the original colour was yellow, I think, was one of the colours, do you see? And so it is reverting to its original colour. And pink is one of the stages that it's in, do you see, that half of the tree is in, going back to its original colour. And in fact, I wrote it out, I typed it out. I didn't tell him then. Because I didn't want to embarrass the secretary, you see. That was the sort of thing I used to do, you see. Didn't want to embarrass anybody. Mm. And yet they always suspected me of things, do you see.
Of conspiring.
And you know, and noting everything to report to Scotland Yard about it. And so I typed this out and handed it to the secretary. Sir Winston wanted to know, here we are. I've had a word with Mr. Vincent, and that's what I found out.
One thing about Churchill, I was going to say, he liked animals.
Oh, he loved animals, of course, yes. And he had the big cat Marmalade. There was a one before that, which I didn't know, as a matter of fact. And then Rufus the First, of course, was given to him, and he loved Rufus very, very much indeed, until its breath started smelling. And then it was run over down in Brighton, and nobody dared tell him during the conference in Brighton that Rufus had been run over. It was only after the conference that he was told, and then he buried it just outside the door at just a few yards from the house at Chartwell, with its own tombstone, flat tombstone, like he himself was to have later on at Bladen. Rufus the First, and then the dates. And then eventually, of course, that was replaced. Rufus the First was replaced by a very, very similar model, Rufus the Second. And when he eventually died in the late 50s, then he also was buried next to Rufus the First. And the tombstones are so they're still there.
They had cats and dogs and
cats. And so he didn't mind cats, as long as they didn't crawl over him. He didn't mind it being at the bottom of the bed, for instance, if it, because they knew, the valet would know that he loved animals and would sort of get the cat to lie at the bottom of the bed occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But to suggest that during the whole time that he was dying, shall we say, at Hyde Park Gate, and that the cat was at the bottom of the bed, no, that was ridiculous to even suggest that. Unhygienic anyhow. Mm-hmm. But so really he didn't mind the cat, but he didn't want them running after the birds, you know. And I've got film, as a matter of fact, of the cat going after the birds. I don't know whether they're going to use it on the 8th, 15th, on the 22nd, on the 22nd of May, but they're going to use quite a bit of a film that I took, especially of Sir Winston painting.
It's movie film, is it?
It's a, yes, what is it, 9mm or 16? 8mm,
yeah.
Yes. And they've cleaned the film up for me, the people that are Brooks Associates that are doing this program, the Churchill family, in three episodes on HTV, I think it is, at 9:30 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the films that I took is there, some of the slides of Chartwell, of the horses, for instance. I think it's Paul Roget. Because he loved horses, and when they were not in training, do you see, during the off season, or even to foal, they would come down and foal at Chartwell, so that he could have a running commentary, if you like, and assist at the birth, if you like.
Really?
I know that happened on one occasion.
Really?
So he loved his horses, but he also they are also going to show the producer. Was very, very terribly happy with the photographs of the pigs, the land race pigs that I had. And Churchill's not even on them. The pigs are there. But he adored those pigs and used to scratch their backs. And he was one of the first farmers or agricultural people in England to import land race pigs from Scandinavia. Very, very long they are and very lean, which was... rather surprising, because he liked a bit of fat himself on his on his meat. So he loved any type of animal. And I remember on one occasion I saw a snake, a viper it was, there's no doubt about it, on the steps leading down to the studio, and I picked up a stone because I saw it, 20 yards away. And he was admiring the view and across to the lakes. And I saw him looking that way, and so I picked up a stone and threw it. And unfortunately, I didn't frighten it away. I hit it on the head and killed it. And so while he was watching, I ran a little bit ahead, and with my foot, I pushed the viper aside. I couldn't ever, of course, tell him that I'd killed a snake.
Really?
He'd probably sacked me straight away. I know I'd have got a good telling off.
Really?
Quite sure. And like Lady Churchill, there were... She had transformed the tennis courts just outside of the gate into a croquet lawn, because it was, you know, she was getting on, and she felt that croquet was much more up to her state of health, if you like, than tennis. And so it was all grassed over, a lovely, lovely lawn. And the croquet sticks were, and everything else were all was there, you see, in a little pavilion. And then the worms began to come, and worm mold, worm mounds, all over the pitch, you see. And so she didn't like this, and she called on Vincent to put down chemicals, you see, to destroy the worms. And they were destroyed. And it was an awful sight to see, for any animal lover, to see all these worms dead upon the lawn. And we got to the entrance, to which there were not a fence, what do you call it, a hedge, all round, you see. And there was a shaped entrance to the lawn, to the croquet lawn. And as we got there one morning, Winston, I must show you how I've got rid of the worms, do you see? And he went in there, and he was so, so cross about it with Lady Churchill. And he told Vincent never, ever to do such a terrible deed again.
Really?
You know, without consulting him. He was terrible. And so, you know, a worm is a worm, after all. It's an insect. I suppose he should have been a Buddhist. But, animals, he loved animals.
Did Churchill go, you're talking about, should have been, did he go to church, or a frequent church?
Only when it was necessary. I remember, I don't know whether I've told you this story or not, we were in Venice, and it was the time when Norman was the valet then, and we had been lunching, he'd been lunching, if you like, with Anne Crawford, who was a film star, coming up film star, and was also a guest at the time at the, can't remember, a duchess, an Italian duchess, Baroness Volpi. And she's got a long name, and I had a letter, as a matter of fact, about it in the Telegraph some time ago, about that same residence when one of our cabinet ministers went there, not too long, about 3 years ago. That's right, Baroness La Contessa di Volpi, the Maserati or something like that. And she had a lovely balcony, do you see, and he went out there and he painted the Rialto Bridge from there. But on this day, he decided that he wanted to go to San Giorgio, the church, one of the great churches there, and which was just down the Grand Canal from where we were. And so they decided, and Anne Crawford decided, you know, that she'd like to go with him, so she went with him. So there was Anne Crawford, Churchill, the valet, Norman, and myself. So we went down there, and with great difficulty, they say there's no tides in the Mediterranean. And I suppose the Venetian waters are. The Venetian waters also form part, really, of the Mediterranean, but there was a tide there. And so with great difficulty, Norman and I, assisted by Anne Crawford, we got him out of the motorboat up onto the landing stage, which led to the back door.
Mm-hmm.
And so we walked along the 100 yards, I would think, along this raised part to get to the back door. And we went along there, and I went on ahead, I preceded them, and pulled the bell, and heard it ringing, several times, ring, and nobody appeared. By the time we got there, of course, 10 minutes had elapsed, and there's still nobody there. We waited for 2 or 3 minutes, and I said, I know there's somebody coming. And there were builders on the right-hand side, and I'd asked them, yes, it should be open. They were working on the walls of the church. And so we waited for a while, and then he said, well, no longer. And off we went, turned round, and with Anne holding his arm, we walked along the towards the motorboat, very disappointed. And as we were walking along, Norman turned round to me, and he said, Eddie, he said, for the first time in 25 years, the old man of his own volition wanted to go to church.
Really?
And they've locked the blooming doors. And suddenly there was a shout behind me, and there was one of the church curés or something.
Yes.
Who came dashing afterwards
but
and
so he
apologising. And so we turned round and went back in. And it was a wonderful experience. Churchill told me that it was a magnificent church inside, wonderful nave and choir, all the rest were wonderful carvings and a wonderful portrait of the supper at Canaan. You know, really beautiful, beautiful stuff. And he was very, very impressed. We spent, a good hour and a half there before returning to La Contessa di Volpi.
But generally speaking, he wasn't a churchgoer unless it was...
No. He would willingly go.
Christmas, Easter, family occasions.
Christmas? No. It would have to be a family occasion.
Right.
A baptism or something like that.
A family occasion or a duty.
Or a duty, yes.
I see. You were talking about he got bad-tempered with people. How frequent was he?
Oh, he got very bad-tempered, yes, occasionally. Occasionally. Very often, as a matter of fact.
Really?
He couldn't abide stupid people or stupid mistakes, for instance. And or forgetfulness, you know, on the part of others. As far as he was concerned, that was all right if he forgot things. I mean, that's what he was paying other people for, to remind him of things and to lead him in the right way. But as far as, yes, if the bath wasn't hot enough, for instance, he'd get very cross with the valet. Or if he'd told the secretaries, for instance, to get in touch with somebody to clear up a point that had been in the news, you know, and they'd either forgotten to do it or done it and forgotten to tell him, or done it and considered that the news wasn't valid or something like this, and he found out that there'd been a discrepancy there, and then he'd be very, very cross indeed.
What would he do?
Oh, just shout. Just shout. Or if they, you know, on occasions, didn't often happen when we were out painting, and even Lady Churchill or Lady Soames, secretaries, came along. He wouldn't shout at Lady Churchill. I remember, you know, when she made a remark about it to sort of open up the as an opening gambit to tell him that it was 1 o'clock and his guests were waiting. She mentioned the fact that it was, you know, this is in Jamaica, a beautiful painting, you know, and she liked the tree or something like this. And he would say, oh, well, yes, thank you, my dear, you see. And then afterwards, when she'd left, you know, he'd say, well, you know, she knew nothing at all about it. But then if secretaries interrupted him, you know, without going through me, and I had a technique, if somebody wanted to tell them, I'd say, hang on a bit, you see, and then I would go to the easel and squeeze out a bit of white paint or something, or pick up a brush, or, you know, or replace a brush, and he would sort of look up and say, well, he'd, you know, look up and see it was my hand that was doing whatever it was being done, and realize, you know, that it was me. And then I would, as he looked up, I would say, you know, well, the secretary's here, so instance. Oh, well, what does she want? Then they could talk. But if they went straight in, you see, his mind was absolutely concentrated on that bit of canvas in front of him. And it always came as a shock if, you know, somebody interrupted him quickly.
Did he start dropping things or throwing things back at people?
Oh, if it was actually a type mistake, you know, yes, it would fly.
Really?
It would fly, yes.
Most
of the time it was oral.
Yeah, but he didn't break things, did he?
No, not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
No. If anything broke, it would be something of very, very little importance, because he had a great sense of responsibility as far as precious things are concerned.
Yeah. Could he knock the old coffee cup on the floor? Or?
I don't think many coffee cups were broken. He could, of course, when he was reading the newspapers of a morning, perhaps, upset the coffee, you know, things like that, but not deliberately.
No.
When he pulled the newspaper up, but not deliberately, I don't think. He would, no. He would, yes, he would blaspheme on occasion.
Ah, really?
You know.
F and nine.
But not as bad as they do on television.
Hold on, hold on.